Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Tortoise Shack podcast. A little bit of housekeeping before we kick off. This is the live recording, or the first part of the live recording, of the sold out Shrapnel podcast at Imagine Belfast. It was widely lauded, and from all corners, it was great. I got so much feedback from the night. We're absolutely thrilled. The Shrapnel goes from strength to strength, and delighted to have the guys on the Tortoise Shack platform. If you like what they do, if you like what the Tortoise Shack does, please help us keep going. We have no ads, we have no sponsors, we rely entirely on you. Please visit patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The link is at the top of the podcast you are listening to right now. Thanks for listening, thanks for the support, thanks for liking, sharing, give the lads a 5-star review. I'm shutting up now, enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Shrapnel Podcast. I'm your host, Sam McElwain. This was another live event. Myself and Gareth took part in last night, which was the 23rd of March, in the Crescent Arts Theatre in Belfast, and was part of the Imagine Belfast Festival. We were joined by our guest, Emma Shaw, who is the founder and CEO of the Phoenix Education Centre in East Belfast. Davy Adams, an ex-Ulster Democratic Party politician and negotiator of the Good Friday Agreement, who went on to work in humanitarian aid around the world. And Beano Niblock, an ex-Loyalist prisoner who's turned poet playwright and whose play, The Man Who Swallowed the Dictionary, is coming back to the Lyric Theatre from the 5th of September. I want to thank our guests for what was a lively chat. We knew that it would be, but it was great to see it unfold. And to everyone who bought a ticket, who came along and who made it a sold-out success, thank you. I also want to thank Peter O'Neill from Imagine Belfast, Alan Meeman for his tech support on the night, and Sarah Herson for her logistical help, all invaluable. Thanks also to you, our subscribers on Patreon, and to all our listeners, no matter where you get your pods from, iTunes, Spotify, thanks to your continued support, we keep doing what we're doing. So please, support us whatever way you can. Enjoy the podcast.
Pressure there, huh?
None at all. Just the usual, Davey.
Yeah.
Well, thanks all for coming. I'm going to keep the info short tonight. Welcome to the Shrapnel Podcast that is live at Imagine Belfast. Myself and Gareth would like to sort of greet our guest again. You may have heard him before on our pod, so I'll keep the introduction short. We have Davey Adams, former politician with the Ulster. The Ulster what now, was it? Democratic Party. Was it Democratic, yeah. Davey? We'll get into that later, I suppose. Who's went on to work around the globe in disaster zones. With Emma, who currently is leading the charge in East Belfast and actually walking the walk that we talk about. And Beano, the man who doesn't need an introduction. His face is everywhere at the minute with a play that has stormed the Lyric and is coming back on again. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you, yeah. So how will we kick this off?
Who'd we pick on first?
Well, what about an easy question? What is loyalism and what does it mean to you, each of you guys?
Start with an easy one, sure. Yeah. I don't
go ahead, Emma.
You opened your mouth.
Okay. Well, I guess we've talked about this before on the podcast. Loyalism is a broad church. You can't define loyalism for one single person. I mean, for me, it's about community and it's about how can I best serve my community. And so for me, it's that it always goes with service. That's the only way that I could explain it for me.
I have to be perfectly honest, and maybe a bit of an interloper then where this is concerned, but I sort of don't class myself now as a loyalist or a unionist. I don't class myself as a nationalist or a republican either, I should quickly add, but I sort of over the years have got to a point where I don't like my views being determined by a tribal sort of loyalty or by others or by feeling you have to fit in, if that makes sense. I think I had a long time of people not necessarily telling me what to think, but me feeling at least that I had to think and say things and act in ways that suited other people. So I just think of myself as part of the Davey Adams gang, if you know what I mean. And that's not to say I don't care about people. I really, really do. But my loyalty, first and foremost, is to my family. And after that, it's to the community at large, all of our community. And that leads me on to something I hope to talk about later, which is reconciliation, which I think is essential for our community. And something that I think has been totally and absolutely ignored, not necessarily on the ground. There are very many decent, upright people and community groups that are working hard towards reconciliation, but they haven't had the support and the example setting and the leadership that they need. So it's not about me divorcing myself from the worries of everyday people. I mean, my background is I'm one of 10 children from a working class family, raised in a 3-bedroom house. So I know all about poverty and all of that sort of stuff. And it never leaves you. That's where my loyalty lies, with working class people. Sorry, I waffled, but sure.
You know?
I slightly disagree with, I understand your sentiments, but I slightly disagree with you. My own point of view is I came from a working class background, grew up in an area which would probably be called an interface now. Lagan Village, the Lower Woodstock Road, Ravenhill Road, and adjoined a short strand. My family on my mother's side were probably very, very staunch unionists/loyalists, steeped in the orange, steeped in the black, steeped in the band culture and stuff like that there. And that's how I grew up, you know. So I would always class myself as a working class loyalist. That view has slightly changed over the years, in my opinion, in that it may be diluted a wee bit over the years, because loyalism doesn't mean the same thing as it did to me when I was growing up in the 1950s, 1960s. But it doesn't make me any less of a loyalist. Do you know what I mean? I was never a royalist, and I'm probably a divorced unionist in many ways because of the way things have gone. But I would still, at the heart of it, class myself as a working class loyalist. Yeah,
you're divorced unionist or a orphaned unionist?
Good question. Because of the way things have went over this past, probably from a Good Friday Agreement, really, in that I was never a voter for a start, and I very, very rarely voted. For a while, I would probably have favoured a party like a PUP, although always knew that in many ways it was a wasted vote because we're never going to reach those heights. But going back in the 1960s, my mum and my mum's mum, my granny, would have took you out of the ham with a Limfield scarf tied around your neck and told you we're going to vote for, at that time in the 1960s, Grafton Pounder, people like that there who were traditional unionists. I hadn't a clue who they were. But you're told, no, look, we're going anyway. And you followed a coal lorry with a flute band in the back of it. And that was the unionism that I was brought up with. That no longer appeals to me because they haven't delivered.
They
won't deliver.
I think as well it's worth mentioning that the latest iteration of loyalists, loyalism as a term, was developed by, I needn't call it big house unionism, but supposedly respectable unionism, to describe people like ourselves as the poor relations, as the working class unionists, paramilitary type unionists, who they could point the finger at.
Or phone when they wanted their dirty work done.
Exactly.
That's yeah.
Or hint strongly whenever they
or blame, and that's the issue I have whenever we talk about criminality with loyalism, because not all loyalists are criminals, and we have to, like, we keep using this word divorce, so I'm going to use it again.
And not all criminals are loyalists either.
And not all criminals are loyalists, exactly. Or do we, whenever we're writing the newspaper articles, do we actually say to somebody, how do you identify? Let me just make sure that I get everything right here. We don't.
I think the term is useful patsies.
Yes.
We're dragged out whenever a bus needs burned, or whenever we need to block a road or make a point or make the headlines.
Or when the politicians want to say things like, you know, we need to be delivering, or we need to get these young loyalists off the street. They need to be better educated, or they need, you know, it's always that derogatory, less than, not as educated, all of those typical terms. And that's like, and I've said this many times, that's why I actively speak out as a female loyalist, because I'm trying to change people's perceptions and the negative connotations that go with being a loyalist. Sometimes it's like hitting your head against a brick wall, because they're so ingrained within society.
And swiftly disowned.
Yeah.
That was the major part of it. You know, that's, you know, that this are these people who are far less than us by so-called mainstream unions.
But I think if we do that, David, we take any ownership of our own actions sometimes out of it as well. We blame others. We were all adults when things happened back in the day.
Yeah.
So I think we need to take ownership
of
that as well, rather than say Paisley led us somewhere else.
No.
We were led. We let ourselves be led at a certain point.
Of course.
So when do we stop that?
But that's not the point I'm making. The point I'm making is that, I mean, loyalism in its latest iteration, its most recent, was a way of distancing mainstream unionism from working class unionism, paramilitary unionism, and all of that sort of thing. It was an us and them, and we were handy for the vote and all the rest of it. But when something went down, they never, you know, an Ulster unionist or whoever would never describe something bad that had happened as having been carried out by unionists. It would have been by loyalists. So loyalism came a term that meant you were either a paramilitary or working class or both.
It was all that dirty word as well. And you mentioned there, like, when do we stop being leaded, or when do we stop letting ourselves be leaded? And
exactly.
I don't think that we're there yet, because, and you've heard me talk, educational disadvantage in working class areas, and it's not just loyalist working class areas, it's across the board. But in our areas where some of our people, young people, older people, can't read and write, they believe, or they listen to the messages that's on the gable wall, and those simple messages from, you know,
140 writers. Characters.
Yes. And it's easy to get people riled up. It's harder to get people to understand the complex nature of what goes on behind the scenes. And even sometimes people that are voting and people that do go out and vote don't actually understand what is within the powers of Stormont and what is not. And we've seen that whenever Stormont was down. And, you know, I actively support Stormont, and I want to see us having our own elected representatives. But at the same time, we need to have better education around what Stormont actually can deliver, because sometimes we're asking them to change things that they don't have the power to change.
Yeah, and I think also that it's not just the education, it's the confidence that comes with education.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of those people in those streets, in the Newtonard Road and the Shankill and Sandy Row, it's a confidence in themselves and a confidence in what they're going to do in the future. And it's the fear that it comes with it when they feel that they can't speak out and they don't have the tongue. I mean, Bino has said, I mean, when are we going to stop acting like the scum that they portray us to be? Mm-hmm. I mean, where does that come in, Bino? How do we nip that?
Yeah, you know, it's like Emma saying there, and I think because of the fractured nature of unionism, it sends out all these different messages. Who do you vote for? Why do you vote for them? What are they delivering? What can I deliver? What's a promise? And it's hard to see from, you know, from a unionist or from a loyalist point of view. You have these messages that you have three main parties, three main unionist parties. You know, that's going to sound very simplistic. why are they not one party? Why have we not got one unionist voice?
I understand what you're saying too, but I don't think that having one unionist voice would appeal to everybody. I do think that voters deserve to have a different choice, what that looks like, whatever party that looks like. But I agree with what you're saying in terms of whenever voters are looking at the ballot and voting down the ballot, whatever it happens to be, is a lot of the feedback that we do hear in the community is why is there not just one PUL voice that I know that I can vote for? And honestly, sometimes I feel like it's too many egos in the room. But
when we start down that one unionist party, you ask two or three simple questions and all of a sudden the vote fragments. So what do you stand on same-sex marriage? How do you stand on women's rights to choose? All of a sudden that one voice becomes several
voices.
That's
exactly what I expect.
That is the problem. Yeah. So whilst there's an enemy at the gate kind of thing, and we can all look at the possibility of 32 county state coming our way, you can focus minds. But when we start to get into the nitty gritty of what that party is and how it sets up, is it a right wing conservative party? I wouldn't be comfortable voting that way. You know, I'm out and out socialist. I mean, I'm out and out left of field. And that's the way I was brought up as a loyalist. And again, Davey is saying this iteration of loyalism. Loyalism moved to the right at some point. I mean, we can probably nail it down to one meeting where they shifted. And that left a lot of us behind. Because if you look at the Mitchell principles, if you look at everything that went before that, it's all left of centre.
I mean, I think we should recognise that this so-called split within unionism, it's the outworkings of what I think of as social Protestantism, where individualism is the main thing. I mean, you've only to take a look at the many Protestant sects and churches and whatever there are. And it's a good thing, actually. I mean, it's about the individual being able to make up their own mind, speak out, articulate their views, and not follow with the tribe. Now, the splits within unionism are part and parcel of that. But what we haven't got is, and it's often down to fear, to be quite honest with you, what we haven't got are people who are brave enough, and very understandably aren't brave enough, to say what they actually think and just go with the flow. And there's a certain amount of laziness in there as well, where, well, the big party says this will be okay for us, so we'll go along with it. But there is a real fear within unionism and loyalism of putting your head above the parapet or putting it too far above the parapet.
But we did it.
And we did it
in the 90s.
But that fear, and I'm saying this from personal experience, that fear can be absolutely justified, believe me.
Yeah.
And it brings me back to my Ussens and Neman's business. When I look back from a childhood onwards, one of my big regrets is that the Northern Ireland Labour Party couldn't withstand the pressures of the sectarianism and all the rest of it that arose with the Troubles and the outset of the Troubles. But that's where we should be heading, I think. Working class people across so-called divides who have absolutely far, far more in common with one another in terms of problems and world outlook and all the rest of it and difficulties they have with they and their families getting from one week to the next without allowing ourselves to be constantly, and when will we ever learn as a society in totality, not to allow ourselves to be turned against each other, and it's purely for electoral gain. Because some of the people who are tearing strips off one another in TV studios are also the same people who are sitting chatting and having friendly cups of coffee and wherever, Stormont or Westminster or wherever. And we are the patsies. And aside from all of that, you know, we have to have some sort of reconciliation here. Or as I keep saying, I'm even boring myself saying, we can't constantly, generation after generation after generation, pass down this poison chalice of hatred and dislike of people that, let's be honest, increasingly we have people growing up who have never knowingly met someone or interacted with someone from the opposite side of this fence that that divides us. I mean, it's ridiculous.
But that's
it really is.
That's because we still live in a very heavily segregated, whether it's housing or schools. And if you look at the segregation across Northern Ireland, it's typically in working class areas. Yeah. And so it's designed that way to almost, and again, you know, if you speak to Joe Bloggs or, you know, Joanne Bloggs on the street, the main concerns for anybody is mostly, where's my kids going to be able to get a house? So we need more social housing. We need better access to better paid employment. And we need better access to the NHS and public services. And I don't think religion or political ideology differs in that. It's if you're in a working class community, that tends to be what people want to see. And so I think, like what you said, David, there is a lot that we can work together to try and achieve. But I do think that we need political leadership, and we have had very little of that in the last 10 years.
But that's difficult when you have institutionalized segregation.
Yes.
Yeah. And it also, look at it cynically, to keep us segregated, to keep the other people in power.
Because turkeys won't vote for Christmas.
Yes.
But let's be entirely honest here. I mean, as someone who remembers right back before the Troubles and afterwards, I grew up, just to be clear, I grew up in a small rural...
Not the Shankill, David,
No. small rural housing estate, very small, and it was mixed. I mean, we were the only Protestants in our tiny row and all the rest. But anyway, I mean, I don't know how we solve the housing situation, the segregation, but I know how it came about. And we can't blame anybody on that but ourselves, actually, because people in different areas were driving their neighbours out. Now, when we go back to that's the honest truth. How we get back to mixed housing is beyond me, but we need to get back to it. But we need as well, obviously, integrated education. We really do need to push that. I think there's a sort of a nod in that direction every so often. I seen something in the papers the other week that a list of integrated schools that are going to miss out in funding. Coincidentally, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We need people to know each other as people. And we need people to know that the person speaking on television doesn't necessarily and often doesn't represent the community that he's supposedly speaking on behalf, he or she's supposedly speaking on behalf of. You know, we take the worst examples from the other side and tend to think it's representative when it isn't. And I know that for a fact. And we really do have to move beyond it, us and them. And we can't put all of the blame on politicians. They have to lead, they have to set an example, all the rest of it. And there are many, as I say, community groups and individuals who are working night and day on reconciliation. But we have to do more, all of us, in everything we say and do and how we act and interact.
But
because
said,
we have so much in common.
But as you said, there is already a lot of community groups that do that, but politicians still hold the purse strings.
Yeah.
And when organisations can't plan, so many of the organisations that work in peace and reconciliation and many other things, community development, you get year-on-year funding, and so you can't adequately plan to run programmes. And our young people, we talk about shared education, integrated education. I've spoke about this before. Many of our state schools are already integrated in all but name, okay? That is a reality. In the school that I'm on the Board of Governors of, we have 50% free school meal entitlement in nearly 20 different languages spoken in our school, but it's still deemed as a Protestant school because it's a state school, when actually it's not just – we have a lot of African dialects, newcomer students, and so – yes, while we have to make sure that young people are learning together, we also can't just integrated education system is not going to be the be-all and end-all that brings everybody together, because it's a segregated education system already costs so much money. Bussing young people out of an area, again, costs money.
And passing other schools. I mean, we've seen reports by Ulster University, even on the carbon footprint of this.
Exactly.
If you're taking politics and religion out of it, we're bussing kids miles past the nearest school to suit a tag that we've given them.
In East Belfast, they always talk about Lagan College being oversubscribed because it's an integrated school, right? I would actually say they've closed three schools in East Belfast, so that also impacts why that school is being oversubscribed. And it also, the first entrance criteria is based on religion. And so a lot of the young people are being bussed from Portaferry, Newton Ards. And so the people that live, or the young people that live in the East Belfast area, can't go to their closest school. So they're then bussed out. So whilst I understand that we do have to teach young people together, and that is important, it can't be, it isn't the one magic bullet that's going to fix everything.
There's no, it's a mindset you have to change.
There's no single magic wand, but there are lots of little things that we can do and push for.
Davey, if it was, it would have happened long before now.
Well, yeah.
You know, there's a mindset within us all.
Yeah.
That we need to be saying, you know, if it's integrated education, per se, it has to come from us all. You know, it's no use saying, as you rightly pointed out, Lagan College is going 40 years. You know, has it made a difference? In your opinion?
Not in East Belfast, because most of our kids don't go there.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So, and Lagan College is set up as an example.
Yeah.
But
now, that's not the... I don't want to make it sound like I'm taking a dig at Lagan College, just to be clear, because they do great work, right?
I mean, sorry, how do you quantify this? And I mean, all I can say is my grandchildren go to an integrated school. It's a fantastic school. And
but do you not think every school should be a good school?
Of course. But what I'm saying is, and I'm not claiming that integrated education is this magic wand, but I think it's essential.
But
people who don't live beside...
Education starts in the home, Davey.
Yeah. Of course.
That's where we need to change the mindset. It's not
course,
the schools.
Of course.
We're sending minds in there already polluted.
But
you need to take that pollution out in the home first.
But people who don't grow up together beside one another can at least be educated together and know one another from early on and recognise they're just the same as you or me or whatever, that we're all human beings. Of course, all of this stuff has to start in the home, and that's why I'm saying that the onus is on every right-thinking person in Northern Ireland to be doing all they can for reconciliation. And part and parcel of that is how you raise your children.
Yeah.
And I mean, anyone, I'm not going to say anything. But part and parcel is also
making sure that organisations that are doing the work are adequately funded and sustainably funded, or assisted to be sustainably funded and led by the right people. So we can't have organisations that helicopter into an area that don't know the players, that don't know, you know, how to navigate in many areas the complex nature of the relationships that are going on with the area. It needs to be local communities that drive that themselves, that are empowered to do that.
Yes, but these aren't competing concepts. These are all, to my mind at least, little bits of the jigsaw that we need to put together. I mean, above all else, there has to be willingness. It's a comfort zone. You know, to me, the human condition is very much about loving the world that's black and white. Goodies, baddies, you know, no grey areas.
Yeah.
Whereas it's far, far more complicated than that, the human world. And we sort of have to come out of that comfort zone of, oh, these people are great. They're terrible. You know, I look at my grandchildren, I'm playing with them and whatever. And I would never, ever have involved myself in the politics of here again, believe me. But I was playing with them, and then I see the news and I say, you know, why doesn't somebody say this, or why doesn't somebody do that, or whatever. And then I had to get to the point where I'm saying to myself, well, there's no sense in you waiting and everybody else saying or sticking their head above the parapet. But it's, the main point I'm trying to make is it's about their future, because we can tiddle along as we are and everybody's saying, well, and I read this pretty often, all the troubles are long behind us, that'll never happen again. Don't you bet your life on it.
Yeah.
Go through the history of Ireland with a fine-tooth comb, and there were always periods of calm and, oh, well, everybody's getting on great and all the rest of it. We have to reconcile. It's as simple as that. And that will mean reconcile, no matter who it is individually or whatever groups or communities, that'll mean reconciling ourselves to some hard truths as well, and moving out of our comfort zone and stop seeing everything in the nice, easy, black and white, goodies and baddies type world.
But then I think that goes, you know, when we're talking about respect and understanding, I think that that has to go multiple ways, because loyalists in general are not seen in positive light. And when we talk about band culture, when we talk about band culture or bonfires or any other things that we would deem as part of our cultural heritage, they get lambasted in the media every single year. I work with young bonfire builders, and every year we hear the same things. They're knuckle draggers, they're this, they're that, they're troublemakers. These young boys are 15, 16, 17, and they're typical 15, 16, 17-year-old teenagers. They're not bad. They're not. They have dreams and aspirations the same as everybody else, but they're vilified every May, June, July. And so when we're talking about reconciliation and we're talking about respect, we also have to help people to understand that we also need respect as loyalists for our cultural identity as well.
Well, I mean, when I say everybody, I mean everybody. But I also very strongly have the view that anybody who is genuine about reconciliation is not, and genuinely wants reconciliation, is not going to allow themselves to be deflected from that by anyone, whether that be supposed political opponents or whoever. I mean, go for it. And I mean, look at the outcry, how joyous people were at the stuff that Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little Pengelly have been doing recently. I mean, people are crying out for reconciliation here. They really are.
But is that real reconciliation? Because we talked about this before. Is that reconciliation, or is it just gesture?
It's set an example. It's showing leadership, but do not ever anyone underestimate the power of so-called gestures.
Yeah, I was going to say, the empty gesture or not, it then breeds it's further, and opens doors to allow other people then to do similar things. But it's acceptable then.
Symbolism is massively important in a post-conflict society, massively important.
In society that we live around symbols and flags and everything
I think it's what
stone delighted.
What I'm saying in that there are hurdles.
Of course.
You know, as you're saying about the bonfire builders and that sort of stuff, you also have a lot of loyalist feel that's been imposed upon them is Gaelic language and stuff like that, or GAA, whatever. But those are things we have to face down and face up to. You know, and it's like what you're saying, in that it's not easy. It's not, you know, other ways we jump over those hurdles. But it's something we have to embrace, and it's something we have to face down, you know, in many ways, as what you're saying, Davey, is to reconcile.
Yeah,
these are the practical things that we face.
But I mean,
you need to develop tolerance, a better understanding of tolerance.
But I mean, you know, what's the challenge in the Irish language?
To me?
No, to anyone. Why should there be a challenge in the Irish language? I mean, anyone who knows the history of Ireland knows that, I needn't say saved, But people who worked most to keep the Irish language alive were Irish Presbyterians and Irish Anglicans at one stage. So it means part and parcel of our history and our culture as well. And Gaelic, I mean, this club in East Belfast, so what? I mean, there's not more important things to be worrying about than youngsters from both sides of the divide getting together to play a sport. You know, who cares? Mm-hmm. Or should care?
But that's a very political. So there's a lot more going on in East Belfast in terms of when we look at where resources are being allocated, and it all comes down to whenever we talk about the post-conflict society and in working class areas, some loyalists do feel like things are constantly being eroded and taken away from them. We look at football pitches that aren't invested in because it goes with the name of the club. But yet there's East Belfast DAA are looking for a pitch, but they won't work with certain people. So it's a lot more complex than just saying, you know, and I don't have any issues with anybody that wants to play Gaelic or speak Gaelic, but you have to understand that within working class loyalist communities on the ground, there still are issues because they do have a complex issues as to what's going on the ground.
You see, this reminds me slightly, Emma, of the whole talk it sort of has died down in recent years. Maybe people just got tired of saying it, but of, you know, post Good Friday Agreement and all of the funds that poured into Northern Ireland that still pour in, where there was they get everything and we're getting nothing. I just say to myself, maybe that's true, but you know, where's the evidence of that? So
there doesn't have to be evidence.
No,
perception.
No, yeah. But to kill that, what we needed and still need probably is a full list of all the funding that come in, mm-hmm. where it went to,
open the books,
who it went to,
just open the books
and what it was used for, who got it and what did they use it for.
Yeah.
And then I would say some people might be an awful lot or would be very surprised. Perceptions, and I know all about perception, you know, but they have to be challenged as well. And the perception may turn out to be right. But if it's wrong, the best thing is, you know, to show it's wrong. I don't for a second think that them's got more than us's in the handouts from so-called peace money. I don't look.
But I think, Davey, what's interesting, particularly with what Emma's talked about before, there's investment in the East Belfast, into the community that you work in, that you you know, done community education in, but is it going to the right people? Or are people being parachuted in and then telling the community what they think they need? And that's where it's a class difference, in my opinion. So 100%. You have people coming in saying, well, we think you guys need this, instead of putting the resources in the type of work you're doing.
Or they don't even say, we think.
Yeah.
They say, here is what you need.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me, it's savior complex. And I actually was at a meeting at Ulster University, and there was a large cohort of different organizations there. And I had a guy say to me, oh, we tried to set up a training organization because I run an education center. We tried to set up a training organization in East Belfast. Nobody was interested. They didn't want any training. And I said, oh, right.
Did he know you were from the East?
No. And then so I says, all right, so tell me a little bit about what happened. So he proceeded to say, oh, you know, and I says, well, did you speak to anybody? Did you engage with the local community? No. But we looked at the government's economic strategy, and I went, right, okay. Okay. Right. But actually what we need to do is engage with people. And like, this is what I'm always saying. You have to engage with people that live in the area, because it's all well and good. You, as whether it's an academic or a researcher or a politician or whatever it happens to be, you might have your ideas of what you think might work in a community, but you don't know that community better than they know themselves. And so that would be my point to try and get across to everybody.
It's a point you've made about gentrification.
Yes.
And the other thing we need to look at as well is, we have communities who are looking at it and saying Vemin's got more. But when you have campaigns like Bill Shankle that are run at the minute, and you look at the waste ground that has land there, and then the call for housing and better facilities in the area, and you can see why it feeds into that mindset, whether it's accurate or not.
But as you say, Sam, Bill Shankle isn't a new, it's a new tagline.
Yeah.
But Jackie Redpath started that in 1974.
See the Shankle campaign,
so it's
yeah.
been going for 50 odd years.
Yeah.
And nothing's been done.
No.
And when was the last time Shankle Leisure Centre was invested in?
The Wave Machine.
Yeah,
the wave machine was there in the 80s.
Yeah, 80s.
With the same crocodile that's still there.
Yeah.
Have you a response there?
It's the Shankle Leisure Centre, the Wave Machine, everybody talks about it. You're like, yeah, in the 80s we were cool for about 3 months. But no, and it is down to that. It's down to that sort of money coming in, visible money coming in. Yeah. There might be other stuff that is happening in the background that people don't see. And there's stuff that goes on that I know that is low impact, but high volume of cash needed to do this because it only affects 3 or 4 people within the community. But it's great work. But until the books are open, until we see that forensically where the money has went and we can say that balances. Well,
that's why I think the us and them we should be talking about as a class, us and them.
100%.
So, you know, 100%. We'll have to get away from the sectarianism and thinking that the other community get more when we're having these sort of dialogues.
But the other community do get more. It's just not religious community get more. It's
it's the wealthy
people. Yeah. And that's where we need to be looking. But do we have the confidence within ourselves to ask those questions? Because if we question big house unionism, are we questioning the union then? Are we questioning our leaders? And I think that's where we need to put a line in the sand and say, no, we can do this.
It's also, I mean, if you think, I mean, I keep going back to East Belfast because of the conversations I've had with Emma, but it's almost seen that if you challenge what's been done in East Belfast and the certain little pockets that have been developed, you're seen as regressive. Mm-hmm. If you're challenging that, then you're seen as a killjoy. You're potentially seen as a bigot, almost, that you don't want outsiders coming in. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing wrong with people investing in the community. It has to be done in the right way and bringing the community along, making sure there's money for education, making sure there's money for communities development, childcare, all the things that people actually care about.
Yeah.
That's where we should be at this stage. So it's a frustration, but then that's packaged into loyalism being seen as regressive and insular.
And we have to trust people as well because, you know, like I can't tell you the amount of times that I have been asked, why am I qualified to run an education centre or why would I send, you know, why would we send funding to you? And this wasn't from big funders. This is from like a low level funder who, we'll not go into that, but I was literally asked, well, why are you the person to do this? Like, what gives you, like, how are you trained? And I was like, well, not only do I have my undergrad from Queen's in international politics and conflict studies, I also have my master's in education policy. That shut it down. But why should I need to say that? I'm from the community.
Because
why should I need
you
to
need
justify
that? Yourself as a loyalist?
Yeah, because I still live in a housing estate.
But there are acceptable loyalists. I mean, Beano's play on Davy. I mean, Davy is elevated to that level. Mm-hmm. Everybody talks about Davy Irvine as some sort of saint-like.
And we're missing that voice, yeah.
And Davy was great, but he was amongst others who were great at that time. And I think it's not to say that Davy just rode that wave. It's to say that he became the acceptable face of loyalism.
Davy's seen as great, but as Billy Hutchinson made the point in the USA, him, Gusty and Davy were at a meeting and people thought, you know, the people in the US, the officials or whatever they were meeting, thought Gusty and Davy were the intellectuals because Billy sat there quietly. He came from the military background. He represented that. Billy was the only one there who had a degree, not Gusty or Davy. So it's all about perception. And Emma's touched on that there.
Well, thank God.
You shouldn't need to have to legitimise yourself through academia or through qualifications.
The point you're making is important, I think, in that I think it's probably common knowledge. Gusty was self-taught to a certain extent, so was Davy. As you rightly say, Hutch had a master's degree, who was probably, on the face of it, more educated than the rest of them. But it wasn't Davy that elevated himself.
No. I mean,
it was his actions that elevated him.
Yeah.
And he was judged on what he'd done and how he behaved.
As somebody who was a great friend of Davy Irvine, a really good friend of Davy's, Davy was highly intelligent. He had charisma. But he also was sincere. And his sincerity shone out. It may not be popular to say it, but Gusty Spence made a remarkable impression on me as well, as a very intelligent man who was nobody's fool at all. And I've seen him facing down a few people at different times who wanted to create this sort of society that Davy wanted to create as well. And Davy would have said this if the creator had still been here. He was very much Davy's mentor. So I had a lot of respect for the two of them. Great deal of respect. And just quickly, I don't want to go on to all this, but the first time Gary and I went down to meet them, we come out sort of amazed. And I looked at Gary and he looked at me. These guys were just saying exactly what he and I had been discussing among ourselves and had exactly the same point of view. So, I mean, the friendships were just natural after that. But, I mean, yeah, that's all I'm saying. It's just my respect for Davy and Gusty knows no bounds. And I told them that at the time. It's not hindsight.
But I've said before on this pod, that was a generation of loyalism that was excellent. It came together. Because they were 30, 40 years ahead of the curve. If you look at the talks that they were having in the Longcash at the time, the plans they were putting together, I mean, they had joint first ministers down on a bit of paper.
Yeah.
They foresaw the issues that came with first and deputy first. And these were working class lads from the Shankill, Newton Ard Road, Lisburn, wherever, had the foresight, the knowledge and the common sense.
It wasn't with sharing power, it was with sharing responsibility, yeah. As they said, in the 1980s.
And yet, we destroyed that plan.
Before that, which you have done, and I know you have as well, have you ever read Tony Novosel's book?
Yeah.
Who sets out what was being proposed in the 1970s, mm-hmm. 1974, and the 10 principles that was set out was written by a 20-year-old prisoner that set the foundation for the Sunningdale Agreement, which was kicked out by big house unionism. Don't forget, with 12 MPs and 11 of them were unionists. They binned us. In 1998, 23 years later, the same principles was set up the Good Friday Agreement.
Absolutely.
And they were written by a 20-year-old Red Hand commando.
Yeah. But that's history that people don't know.
Yeah. But we're seen as regressive and we're seen as the knuckle draggers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. But to get back just a wee bit to what we were discussing earlier on, and sort of what it ties in a bit with my thinking on how I introduce myself, it's not that I'm trying to divorce myself from my community or whatever in the slightest. But we just keep allowing ourselves to be led to the top of the hill after. The DUP despised us when we first emerged because we were an electoral threat, but also we were refusing to go along with the old story, as usual, march to the top of the hill and left her to shoulder the blame, of course. But it's still happening.
I don't think you can say people. I don't think you can say people are being led to the top of the hill, because for me a big issue is the electorate don't vote. Like, our young people, predominantly in East Belfast, don't vote until they're over 26.
But the point I was going to make is, I mean, take this last couple of years. The DUP pushed through not only Brexit, the hardest possible Brexit, against the wishes of a majority of the electorate in Northern Ireland. They then fought and argued over the protocol and all the rest of it, as if it had nothing to do with them. Stayed out of Stormont for 2 years. And I mean, will they pay for it electorally? I doubt it. And I mean, after the Good Friday, and it's just all over the place, but I hope you stick with it. After the Good Friday Agreement, unionism set back. Just, oh, well, that's not done with. That ceasefire's pocketed and decommissioning on an assembly. The whole objective, the whole reasoning behind the Good Friday Agreement was reconciliation. But it was ignored. Unionism, of all the parties, should have been spent their time making the union acceptable to everyone. Instead, what we did, and we can't blame the parties, just what we did was vote the DUP in and destroy the Ulster Unionists, who had the main unionist negotiators of the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, it's depressing when you think of it. And it's about this, to my mind, that at the end of the day, tribalism still trumps everything.
I would actually go back to what you've said in terms of, like, it's the classism, because yes, Good Friday Agreement happened, right? But see, if you look at the main areas where interfaces are, where all the trouble spots were, they're working class communities, right? And when we look at where the investment went, the investment did not go into those communities. The investment went maybe into organizations, but it hasn't went in to make real, meaningful, lasting changes, like tackling education, like tackling housing. Like, in some places we did get better houses because houses had to be pulled down because there were streets and streets of, you know, built, blocked up houses in East Belfast. So we did get some new houses, but you can't just say.
When we look at the investment that does come in, because I listen to the news and you hear 300 new jobs coming into a certain area, and you're like, okay, well, either fall into two sectors, call centre, that's going to pull out in 2 years' time when the funding stops, or it's in jobs where our kids aren't qualified yet because they don't have the educational attainment.
Even apprenticeships now, if you look at apprenticeships now, so looking at East Belfast, you will know, walking across the bridge at the end of the shift, you know, from the shipyard and the docks, there would have been hundreds of men, right? Now, take away the decline in the industry, right? But if we look at the apprenticeships for the young men who are coming out of school, that's traditionally the route that they would have went, right? Now, when we look at that, you need your grade C, at least in English and math, to go into your apprenticeship for the vast majority of cases, right? That's not every single case, but for the vast majority of cases. And our schools are not always putting our young people through math, GCSE and English. They're putting them in essential skills. And in some cases, they're putting them in essential skills level one. For those of you that don't know in the room, that's a grade D. Right. So if you're not even giving that young person the opportunity to achieve their essential skills level two, which would be a grade C, what job options do they have? You've now said to them, right, you've finished school, you have to go to tech because apprenticeship isn't open. You, we're diverting people into low income jobs where they can't do any better, where there is a certain level of only going to be what they can achieve. And so we need to address the education and training needs of working class communities so that they can be empowered to progress however they choose to, whether it's into employment or into university or entrepreneurship. But we do need to address the lack of educational investment.
Yeah, and we also need to look at, we talk about the likes of Harland Wolff and Short Brothers. They were traditional routes for young Protestant boys coming to working class areas. But they've been shut for some time, and yet we still haven't pivoted to where we need to be looking. I mean, we've always looked at the Republican Nationalist community and said that they went through the educational route because they knew they needed a degree, they needed that to get a job. We haven't yet learned that lesson and shifted. Who is holding us back? Is it us? Is it those that we vote in? Or is it something outside of that?
Or a mixture of all of the above. But also, I think, we have to be wary as well of constantly inadvertently putting ourselves down, because it sort of leads to a cycle of, you know, low expectations and all the rest of it. And
but it's not us putting ourselves down. It's the media that they put out these things about loyalism and bonfire builders especially. So these young boys then see themselves and it becomes a perpetual cycle.
Defy them. You know,
I think it's interesting because we always talk about education not being a big part of the Protestant working class experience. And, you know, I've done research into that. But here we're sitting with two guys who pre-Troubles went to grammar school, ultimately got involved in loyalist militancy to varying degrees.
Well, there's four of us on the platform who went to grammar school.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of the panelists
and
people who did get involved in organisations to varying degrees, they went to grammar school. Education was valued.
Education, I mean,
It was valued.
And that my parents. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say that would be something that I would always push back against because. Yeah. So when I was at uni, I was always hearing academics say working class Protestants aren't interested in education, and that was not my experience growing up. It wasn't the same as my friends. It wasn't, you know. And so what I decided to do, one of my professors allowed me. I wanted to do it as a subset, but he was like, "Why don't you do it as your dissertation?" And I was like, "Oh, I can do that. Happy days." So what I actually did was go into 6 post-primary schools in East Belfast and speak with young people ages 11 to 18 and ask them, do they feel education value? Are they encouraged to do their homework? Are they encouraged to go to school? And what sort of jobs? There was a lot of different questions. But actually 98% of those young people that responded did say that their parents or carers encouraged them to go to school, encouraged them to go to homework, and encouraged, and their parents attended parent-teacher meetings. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to move away from that stereotype that working-class Protestants aren't interested in education. And one final point, and then I'll stop. But when we talk about that, that's the sexy headline, right? What we actually don't look at is, Tony Gallagher's done a lot of research in that, and one of his pieces is, working class Protestant boys achieve worst and Catholic girls who are not entitled to free school meals achieve best. There's 30 points difference in that. But what people don't talk about is there's only 3 points of a difference between working class Protestant boys who are entitled to free school meals and working class Catholic boys who are entitled to free school meals. So again, it's the class dynamic. It is not that working class Protestants don't value education.
I mean, just personal basis. I mean, I've always wondered about this and that value in education because it makes me feel very old because when I was growing up, you know, my parents were pushing us all the time and I knew the neighbours' parents were doing the same. Getting an education. I passed what was then called the qualifying, but I should say as an example of how small an area I came from, there was only 2 of us in primary 7, me and another girl were both sailed through it. And my mother used to say, you couldn't pay for that one-on-one education that you're getting, you know. So, but, I mean, I've often wondered about that, just saying to myself, you know what? It's different now than it was then, you know.
David, you say you sound old.
You are old.
So, I know. Sorry to remind you.
But then we got the 11 plus. Then
but
we
of
got
her?
Well, that's
oh.
It. I've got on the face.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, here we go.
You're going to get filled in after this. Going to play up the stereotypes.
But then we got the 11 plus, and then we tried to do away with the 11 plus. Yeah. Katrina Rowan done away with 2009 or 2010. And the grammar schools went, no, actually, we still want to keep grammar schools, so we'll create our own.
We privatised selection.
Exactly. And we privatised GCSEs, and yeah. We privatised. So actually, who is benefiting from not only segregating religiously, but segregating in class and schools as well, the grammar schools and the non-grammar schools?
So can we agree?
No.
That from now on,
from now on,
when we talk about us and them,
how do we define
this? That's what I'm about to say. We're talking about us are the people up there, and them are all of us people down here, regardless of politics, religion, or whatever.
It's
the big shots up here who are them.
So it's class.
Exactly.
This is where the Davy Adams revolution starts.
Yeah. Storm the Bastille tomorrow, Davy.
But I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
It's the most ridiculous thing. I've worked in some of the worst trouble spots in the world. And, you know, and I hate to say this because it sounds like an insult. But, I mean, this place, it's actually, in comparison, it's so simple. It really is. And we have had that much attention because we're white, Christian, Western, and all the rest of it. And I think, actually, we've had too much attention. We have had too much where we sit back and expect everybody else to do it for us. Let's get this sorted out. We can't keep passing it down generation after generation after generation.
But the rest of the world hangs on our words, David. You know, everybody watches Northern Ireland. This is where the centre of the universe is.
We're only 1.8 million people. Do you know the whole of the UK and Ireland could fit in the state of Texas 3 times?
Yeah.
When they ask me where I was from, I'll tell you something very funny. When most of the people asked me in what these countries where I was from, they always thought I was saying Holland. And that's it. And I said, so I had to draw a map, England, Ireland, you know. But this wee Syrian man, we were living in his deserted house, you know. And he was got my good old mate, you know, interpreter. He was asking him, you know, for about my background and the many brothers and sisters I had. And he says, is he Syrian? Are you, no, is he sure he's not Muslim? And, but it reminded me of when, whenever I was over the talks, during the Good Friday talks, this big guy, big SDLP guy, lovely fella, you know, but he obviously hadn't known much about, but he asked me the same question one day. I told him I have 1 of 10 children and all that. You sure you're not Catholic, do you? Seamus Mullen was sitting, Seamus looked over, he says, fucking idiot. Seamus is straight as ever, you know.
I think to move on from it, and if we're going to talk about reconciliation, we need to be looking at the tools we need for that, to deal with it. We can look at the big structures we need to put on at the top, but we need to look at a ground level. And I think Beano's trip into the arts as such shows young working class boys who have struggled through the troubles or who endured trauma, there's an outlet, and an acceptable outlet. It's not... sissy, we'll call it sissy, to be involved in the arts. They're not going to be looked down upon. What he's actually doing is bringing a story to life for everybody else, you know.
Yeah.
That was a brave step on Beano's behalf to do that, from the background that he's from, to take that step forward and present that story. I mean, was it easy, Beano?
Hey guys, we're well aware that 2 hours in one sitting is pretty tough going. We felt that on the night, kind of kept talking for hours, but we know this is quite hard to give up 2 hours of your time to listen to one podcast, so we're going to take a break here. Please catch the next half of this. It doesn't disappoint. And thank you for your support. If you can, subscribe to us on Patreon. It helps keep the mics on. It helps keep us moving the way we're going. And give us any feedback you can. Share, rate, like, whatever you can. Tell your friends and spread the shrapnel word. Thank you.